of Advent. It's the first Sunday of Advent and the first day of December. And Advent comes from a Latin word. It comes from the word advenire, which means to come. The Oxford English Dictionary defines this term as the arrival of a notable person or thing. And so for Christians, this arrival is symbolic, says a writer on EuropeanLanguageJobs.com. It's symbolic of the coming of Christ to the world in the form of man, and so the period of Advent marks the patient and expectant buildup to this special moment. So our season that we're celebrating, we've said this before, I think, it's not the Christmas season yet. This is the patient and expectant buildup to the Christmas season. And so in this season, we're not celebrating yet that Christ has come, but we are looking forward to his actual coming. And so it's kind of a celebration of waiting. During this time, we are acknowledging the Jewish people in the Old Testament, how they were waiting for this promised Messiah, this promised ruler who was going to restore their people to greatness under God. And we also remember the first Christians, the people that were present when Jesus was actually born. We remember his first coming, and we're anticipating celebrating that in a few weeks. And we're also anticipating the second coming of Jesus and celebrating how he shows up in our lives in the meantime, which is why Sam's testimony this morning was so powerful. So the coming of Jesus, all of the comings of Jesus, are about God becoming one of us, to reconcile with us. And so that's why today I'm standing down here, because I sort of feel like it symbolizes a little bit this, not that I'm Jesus, but that we're all down here together. Jesus came to be one of us, and he is here. And so this sermon I'm going to preach down here, I'm not really sure what the rest of the Advent sermons are going to look like, because I haven't written them yet. but today is going to be a little bit more interactive and a little less formal. And so I'm going to get some of your feedback at different points today. So since we're celebrating Advent, we're celebrating waiting, sometimes I think this season should not be called the coming, it should be called waiting, the waiting. We're all waiting. We're waiting for Christmas, like Barb said. We're waiting for presents or parties or people to come over to our house or maybe family drama or some disappointments. There's some kind of waiting, good or bad, that happens during this time of year. And so I want to know, what are some other things that you guys are waiting for at this period of time? Can be Christmas related. It doesn't have to be, though. Clarity. Okay. MTEL scores. Right. I was going to ask you how that went. Snow. Sydney. Peace. We'll talk about that next week. You'll have to wait. Any other things that people are waiting for? Right? Flights? If people are trying to travel today and they get stuck with the snow, they're going to be waiting for a while. So there's all kinds of waiting that we're always kind of waiting for something, right? Some of us were waiting for Black Friday sales. Paul and I are getting ready to take a trip in February, but we didn't want to buy our tickets until Black Friday, just in case, or maybe Cyber Monday, just in case the prices went down. So there's all kinds of waiting. So now here's another question. When you have to wait for something, are you good at it? Does it depend on what it is? Yeah. What are some things that you need? What are some inner resources that you need to wait well? Patience. You have to. That's true. Right. That's a really good point. You have to wait.
Because if you didn't, some of my friends, I lost a lot of friends in our
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to have patience, and you have to know that you're going to be waiting. You kind of have to get your head in that place where this is what I'm doing right now. I'm waiting. We talked about patience 2 weeks ago in our James series, and actually the whole time I was preaching that sermon, I was like, this is really kind of an Advent sermon. But one of the things that we said was that patience is hope in action. I think one thing that we really need when we're waiting for something, if it's something good especially, is hope. If you are not hopeful for that thing and that you're going to get that thing eventually, it's really hard to wait. You might despair. You might give up, right? So now let's talk about hope. That is our theme for today. How would you describe hope? Would you describe hope? Yeah. Hope. Expectation? Oh, that's really... Hope is a good feeling when you have it. And it does kind of lift you up. But here's a question. What happens if you have to wait super long and your hope just keeps getting pushed off and pushed off and pushed off and pushed off? How do you feel about that?
Anxious.
Anxious?
Oh, yeah.
Discouraged. That is true, and you can know that in your head, that it's going to come when you need it. But I think some of us still kind of struggle, even if we know that intellectually. So I'm going to tell you a quick story. I've sort of alluded to this a few times, but there was a period in my life where I hated the word hope, and if you had asked me to describe it, I would have said, because I really wanted to say this out loud to somebody, hope is a four-letter word that should not be in the Bible. And the reason I said this is because I was really angry. My hope was being put off and put off. And so there's actually a verse in Proverbs that talks about this. It says, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled is a tree of life. And so my heart was sick. Here's what happened. I had just turned 30. I had just moved back to the United States from 5 years in London. And to be quite honest, I was still single, and I had maybe gone on 5 dates in my entire life, and I had never had a significant relationship, and I really wanted one. That was my hope at that point. And certain things happened, and people said, oh, well, maybe God called you back to the States so you could meet somebody, and I got my hopes up, and then there were a couple of interactions that I thought seemed hopeful, and then everything kind of crashed and burned, and I was like, hey, God, I thought you said this was going to work out for me. I thought this was something you told me. And I got very angry and very bitter. My hope was being deferred, and it made my heart sick. My heart was really sick. And this, I think, is what can sometimes happen when we're waiting for God. So how do you foster godly hope when your heart is sick? Because I think this isn't just something that I went through. I think all of us go through periods of time where we are hoping for something and we believe that God has said we'll have that. Obviously, I did end up getting married, but it was like 10 years later. So how did I not turn into this shriveled, bitter thing? How do we cultivate godly hope when our hope is deferred? How do we keep a healthy heart? I will say that in my case, throwing myself and my dashed hopes honestly against God, I didn't stop believing in God. I kind of wanted to, but I couldn't. But kind of throwing myself at him and letting myself be angry and telling God I was angry, being honest with God, the process of doing that, strange as it may seem, it actually redirected my focus off of the things that honestly couldn't fulfill me in themselves. I could have met somebody and had a relationship, and actually there kind of was one, and that would not have fulfilled me if my connection with God had not been restored. But being honest before God enabled me to redirect my focus off those things that couldn't fulfill in themselves and taught me how to truly hope and what and who to truly hope for. My hopes were actually too small. So Romans 8, 18 through 25 talks about this. It says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. So our relationship with God affects all of creation. It also says, we know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. So hope is, it only works if the thing that we're hoping for we don't already have, right? It is for something that we will receive, but we don't have it yet. And true hope, godly hope, sustaining hope, the kind that, as Kathleen says, kind of lifts us up, is hope for something that lasts. Our core hope as human beings, whether we know it or not, is for reconciliation. And that's what this Romans passage kind of talks about. Creation, everything is just waiting for us to be saved, for all of God's people to be saved, for us to be reconciled. Jesus Christ came in the flesh to reconcile all things. And this same hope is expressed in the Old Testament in our passage for this morning. So we've done this here before. We're going to do it again. It's called Lectio Divina. And I'm going to read the passage that Barb read for us earlier. I'm going to read it three times. And I will remind you between each time what's going to happen. The first time I'm going to read it, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes and just listen. And just kind of let the words wash over you. And see what you notice. The second time, I'm going to ask you to turn your imaginations on a little bit, because this passage talks about many nations. So imagine that you are one of the people in the one of the people in the throngs of people from the nations. And we probably won't feedback this part, but just to kind of get yourself into the passage a little more, imagine what nation are you from in this picture as you're putting yourself into it. And what are you feeling? Are you nervous? Are you feeling anticipation? Do you feel like it's crowded, maybe, with all these throngs of people? Are you happy? Are you anxious? Are you hopeful? The third time I read it, ask yourself, what is your hope as you hear this passage read the final time? Okay, so everybody close your eyes, and I'm going to read it the first time. The first time, just listen. This is what Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for the many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Okay, the second time, imagine that you are one of the people in the nations and notice how you're feeling. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. This third time, ask yourself, what is your hope? This is what Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. So what did you feel or notice, or what hope did you find yourself hoping as you listened to that passage? Paul?
If I'm standing in the midst of that many people, I hope that I can see
what's going on. Hope that you can see what's going on in the crowds. Yeah, that's a good one, actually. Carl? Peace, yeah, peace for the world. That's definitely in there. Oh, of all the nations praying? Yeah. I love that picture.
Clarity.
That what it says in the passage is going to happen? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This sounds great. Bring it on. Yes. So I think this passage really highlights well that total reconciliation is the goal of human hope. And it kind of underlies all of our other hopes. And we might hope for other things, and that's fine. It's totally fine. But there's nothing else on earth that is going to fulfill us at our core the way this reconciliation that God wants to bring and that God has been promising since the Old Testament, until that is fulfilled. So let's just look really quick at these, each verse by verse at this passage and see where the reconciliation is. In verse 1, this is what Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. So we saw that in Romans 8, Paul says, you don't see what you hope for. Well, Isaiah actually saw what he was hoping for. He didn't see it in the fulfilled way, but he had enough of a vision of this hope that he was able to write it down and communicate it to other people to try to elicit hope in them. In verse 2, it says, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it." So this is actually really significant. In the ancient world, in Greece, notably, they talked about Mount Olympus, but also in the Canaanite religions and other religions in the ancient world, people believed that the gods kind of lived up on the top of the really high mountains. Well, the Israelites had a mountain for their God, too. They called it Zion. It's where the temple was built. It wasn't the tallest of all the mountains in the world, but it was significant to them because God was there, and they knew that this was the one true God. And so this verse, this teeny little verse, verse 2, is actually saying the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains, not literally, but it means that God is the real God. His authority is above all of those other gods or concepts or whatever. He is the one true God over all the other powers and the God of all the nations, not just the Israelites, but everybody. So reconciliation in this verse comes with God acknowledged as the only God, the supreme God, over all the other nations. And when that happens, when he is acknowledged that way, the conflicted spiritual realm will be healed. We talked a little bit last week about, you know, there's kind of a conflict within the spiritual realm. Reconciliation is needed on all levels, and it starts in the spiritual realm, where God is acknowledged as absolute God. Verse 3, many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. Excuse me. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So all of the people, all of these nations that we just mentioned that God is God over, they are all going to stream to Jerusalem to learn about God, the true God, from God. God himself. Yeah, I know, Benjamin. It's so exciting. They are going to learn about God from God. And then it says the law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. They will learn it so well that they will be able to take it out of Jerusalem throughout the earth. The reconciliation in this verse comes when the divine and the human rift is healed. We are able to interact directly with God. God is able to teach us directly about himself. Verse 4. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. So God is the final authority, no matter what our heritage. Doesn't matter what country we're from, who our ancestors were, where they came from, does not matter. God is the final authority. He's going to judge between the nations. It says he's settling disputes, which kind of indicates that he's not deciding on the basis of this nation over here is a good nation, this is a Christian nation, this nation is an atheist nation or a communist nation or a Muslim nation. The nations aren't labeled like that. He is deciding on a case-by-case basis, presumably by how reconciled they are, on the basis of reconciliation, whether they are reconciled, whether the people are reconciled to him and growing in reconciliation. With the disputes settled, all of a sudden, we don't need wars anymore. There's nothing to fight about, right? So people won't be spending all their time training to fight. Instead, they'll take their weapons and turn them into farming implements, which is a fulfillment of what God intended humans to do at the creation of the world. We were supposed to take care of the earth. And so there's no more war training, and there's care for God's creation. The reconciliation is humans are reconciled with humans. We're not fighting each other. And because we're not fighting with each other, we're reconciled with creation. We can take care of it. And this is why in Romans 8, it talks about creation is groaning. Creation is suffering the consequences of us fighting with each other, of us fighting with God, of the spiritual realm being divided. When Jesus comes to reconcile us, all of these things will be healed. And so in verse 5, come, descendants of Jacob, let's walk in the light of the Lord. After all that, why would we not want to walk in the light of the Lord? Right? The spiritual realm is healed. The rift between us and God is healed. The rift between each other is healed. And suddenly creation is healed. Why would we not want to walk in the light of the Lord? And for that matter, right here in this building, most of us, maybe some of us are, but most of us are not descendants of Jacob that this passage was written to. And so we are already benefiting from the fulfillment of this promise, reconciliation. We would not be able to come to church and worship this one true God if Jesus had not come to reconcile the people. So let us walk in the light of the Lord. This brings us to communion. Communion is the physical sign of our invisible hope of reconciliation. God came to earth as a human being, and there is biblical reason to imagine that even if we had not sinned, God would have still come down here. Jesus would have still come because God made us to be in fellowship with us. He was walking with Adam and Eve in the garden. I think God has always wanted to live with us. But we did sin. And because we sinned, all of these rifts were created. The rift between us and God, the rift in the spiritual realm, the rift between each other, the rift between us and creation, and even the dividedness within our own selves. Because we sinned, we needed Jesus to come to earth, not just to live with us, but also to bring about our reconciliation, the reconciliation of all of these things. So the principal offenders, that's us, that's human beings, we needed a representative to defend us, a representative who was one of us. Jesus was one of us. He was the only representative of us with a perfect record. The principal offendee, the person who was offended by us, was the Trinity God. And he needed to be the one to extend forgiveness. He was the one that had to do it first before we could begin to forgive each other or anything else. And he did it through Jesus, who was one of us, but also God himself, who willingly, lovingly experienced the full effects of our rebellion against him and then forgave us for it. Communion commemorates this act, Jesus' broken body and poured out blood through his death on the cross. At our hands, the perfect sacrifice for imperfect people to reconcile us to him, each other, creation, and ourselves. So as you come to the table this morning, just remember this. Contemplate this act that Jesus did for us, for you. And in hope, contemplate the picture of reconciliation that we read in Isaiah 2. Contemplate your hope. And with that, let's stand together